From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Look, there's no reason to freak out, at least not right now. But the astronomer Philip Plait says the universe is trying to kill you. I mean, think about it. Colliding galaxies and exploding stars and gamma ray bursts. And then, of course, there are asteroids. Plait says he spent a good part of his career trying to calm people's fears. But in a book he wrote a few years ago, he promised not to hold back. He says he set out to go over in loving detail the possibility of the Earth's atmosphere being ripped away and all life sterilized down to the base of the crust. Philip Plait is our guest today. We're going to talk to him about science nonfiction, as well as his efforts to encourage skepticism and critical thinking in popular culture. It's a big universe, and there's a lot to talk about. So join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The astronomer Philip Plait says there's something going on in popular culture. Something's changing. Used to be the space nerd or the skeptic got shot down in the last moments of your typical sitcom. But now the skeptics, the geeks, are the good guys, the stars of the show. You may know Philip Plait as the so-called bad astronomer or the writer for the blog Bad Astronomy. Plait has spent the last few years of his career challenging superstition and myth in science and encouraging critical thinking and skepticism. Really, he describes his job as going around telling people how cool astronomy is, cool and scary, at least when you think about colliding galaxies and exploding stars and careening asteroids. He's joining us today to talk about, well, to talk about a lot, talk about the universe. Philip Plait created and writes the Bad Astronomy blog on Slate.com. He worked on the Hubble Space Telescope for 10 years. He's the author of two books, including Death from the Skies, The Science Behind the End of the World. Philip Plait, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Well, I wanted to begin with this story that I heard you tell once. I think you were five, and your parents had gone out and bought you this, I guess, pretty rudimentary, basic telescope, and you were setting it up in the driveway, and you looked in it, of course, and you saw Saturn. And it's, in some ways, it sounds like that was kind of a really important moment from you, like kind of a clincher in your life in some way.
Well, absolutely. When you're young and impressionable, seeing something like that is really going to have a profound effect. And in my case, I was already, I mean, even probably in utero, I was probably already really interested in science, right, taking blood samples and you know, amnio samples in my mom. but actually, I really liked science fiction. I really liked science. I loved dinosaurs and all that stuff. You know, your typical kind of kid.
Yeah.
And I don't know why my folks bought a telescope. It may have been some astronomical event that was going on. You know, there's always a surge in telescope purchases when there is a comet or something like that. You know, I don't know why it was, but the fact is they did. And yeah, it was a junky department store telescope, but that's all it takes to look at Saturn. Your binoculars will show you the rings. Even a small telescope will show the rings pretty clearly. And I remember, for all I know, my memory's a little distorted over time, but I do remember my father taking me out and showing me Saturn through the eyepiece. And it's like Saturn is unlike a lot of astronomical objects in that when you see it through a nice telescope, it looks just like in the pictures. You see the planet with the rings, and it's amazing. And basically right then and there, I thought, yeah, this is what I want to do.
Did you know what that meant, what you want to do?
You know what anything means when you're five? I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Yes, I'd like to study quantum theory. No, it wasn't anything like that. It was just, I love this. This is fantastic. I want to do more of this. And over the years, looking back on it, there was never any doubt what I wanted to spend my life doing as far as astronomy went. That was it. The irony is that I've had like five different careers in astronomy over time. I've changed what I've actually done, but it's always centered around it. That's always been sort of the gravitational source of my career.
You write about this in your book, Death from the Skies. You write about how there's some competition for the title, but you say actually astronomy is the world's oldest profession.
Well, sure. You might think that prostitution is, but in fact, the cycles in the sky, the rising and setting of the sun, the moon, the stars, these are all tied to the Earth spinning and the Earth going around the sun. And so they're tied to day and night and the seasons. And if you're an agricultural, even if you're not an agricultural society, if you're just a hunter-gatherer, you need to know, you know, when this star appears, it's going to start getting warmer. This is when the river floods. This is when I'll be able to plant my seeds. This is when I should be harvesting my crops. It's the world's first calendar. The first alarm clock is the sun rising in the morning. And so knowing astronomy is essentially knowing life itself. You have to support your people, your tribe, your town, your city, using astronomy. So astronomers, and back then, you know, thousands of years ago, it was the same as astrology. But these people who would be able to predict the weather, the seasons, all of this, were critical to an agricultural society. And they were all astronomers.
Mm. You mentioned in the book how the moon and the sun were, you know, looked at like gods. You know, studying the sky, you say, was tantamount to worship. So I guess at some point superstition creeps in, and this is how we get astrology, I suppose. People are trying to kind of, I think you say it in the book, tie their lives to the sky. Is that always that give and take, where you have science and something rational, and then you have something like astrology, something that's more based on superstition or something else?
I think so. Now, I'm not a psychologist. I'm not an evolutionary biologist. But it's clear that human beings are always dealing with this push and pull of rationality versus irrationality, of observing the world around us and trying to figure out cause and effect, but also being easily fooled by causes and effects. Yeah. When you see something happen and then you see a second thing happen, it's really easy to tie them together, even if they have nothing to do with each other. So, you know, I happened to see a shooting star and the next day I found my true love. Oh, right. Meteors are a portent of your love life. It's very, very easy for us to do that. Science is essentially the method which allows us to figure out if that connection is real or not, if we're fooling ourselves or not. And it's hard to be a scientist, especially one who talks to the public all the time, yeah, without having to deal with that. And so for me, astronomy walks, and science of any nature, walks hand in hand with topics like logical fallacies, optical illusions, all of that stuff. It's all part and parcel of the way we perceive the world around us. And it's a lot of fun to think about on both sides, on the science side and on the side of more irrational belief systems.
There was what was the point at which you start? You just mentioned how you like to talk to the public now. It's what you're doing right now about science, about the universe. There was a point when you kind of, it seems like you left research almost. Not that you've left it entirely, but you put that part of your career aside for a time and started doing more educating the public, or at least talking to the public. What was were you surprised your career took that turn? And how is it that it ended up you're doing stuff like this?
Surprise is a constant factor in my life. I wake up every morning and it's like, look what I get to do today. Yeah. You know, I'm going to be on the radio. That's so cool. In a lot of things in life, it's not just you wake up one morning and go, huh, I'm going to change everything I'm doing completely. It's not like that. Things ramp down and other things ramp up. And for me, I guess I'd started working on writing on the web when the web was brand spanking new, like on the very first Electron, literally 1993. Wow. When the first browsers were out there, Mosaic, if anybody is ancient enough to remember. And I just started doing it because it was fun. Yeah. And over time, it just got bigger and bigger. And by the time I had gotten my PhD and was working on Hubble, it was just more and more fun. I wound up going to a local nature center where they had some greenhouses and different things where people could come. And I noticed they had a telescope. And I said, hey, if you guys ever need any help doing astronomy stuff. And they were, oh my gosh, thank you. They had a meteor shower coming up and they needed an astronomer because they weren't really sure what to do.
Right.
So I said, nah, I'll take care of it, and organized it and everything, and realized that this is what I want to do. And it was a lot of fun. And it just took over more and more of my life. For one thing, I'm better at this than I am at research, just to be clear. But also, it's more fun. It's more rewarding for me to talk to folks about it, to see their reaction, to point them in the right direction and say, look over there. Look at this cool thing. And to see their eyes light up. That's, to me, that's the whole world. I love it.
I read at one point where you kind of compared what you do, getting up in front of people and talking about science, to stand-up comedy. Like that there's this overlap between scientists and comics where they have this routine in some way, I guess. Explain what's the overlap.
Well, there's just sort of the obvious, you're going to get up on stage and hold people's attention for the next hour talking about something. And that's what a comedian is. And the audience is there to see you. And they have some interest in what you're going to talk about, but they don't know exactly what it's going to be necessarily. And so there's certainly that. That's a very broad way of looking at it. But Chris Hardwick is a stand-up comic, and he runs the Nerdist.com, the Nerdist empire, media empire. And I started listening to his podcast, and it just struck me, all of the things that he does, where he's practicing his talks, he's trying new material, you know, worrying about whether people are going to connect with what he's saying. And just the thoughts that run through your head on stage where it's like, yeah, this isn't working. They're not laughing. They're just looking at me when I make a joke. And that really connected with me, especially since I've always been a bit of a class clown. I like to cut up and be funny. And that's something I do in my talks a lot. I think people might expect sort of the dry, yes, this is an asteroid and here's how they work. And it's not like that at all. I have a lot of fun with my talks. And there is a lot of comedy in there as well, although it's not like doing a stand-up act. Yeah. But being funny is being funny, whether you're a stand-up comedian or doing an improv troupe or just inserting humor into a talk. There's a lot of overlap there. And so I find it interesting to listen to actors, comedians, musicians, anybody like that who has to stand on stage, command the attention of a large group of people and do something with it. It's fascinating to me how that works.
You've described astronomy as awe-inspiring and as beautiful, and you've written that it provides, this is how you put it, a philosophical perspective, the secret answers to many of our most profound questions. What are you getting at there? What do you mean? How can astronomy give us perspective on these deep philosophical questions?
I'm biased. I love astronomy. And so I have to sometimes back off and think, you know, am I being unfair? Is this because I love this field so much? And then I realize, no, it's astronomy. This is so cool. Yeah. When we have a lot of basic questions as thinking beings, how did we get here? Is this all there is? You know, what's beyond my own perception? A lot of this overlaps naturally with astronomy because when you're looking out in the universe, you are looking at everything. Mm-hmm. How did the universe come into being? How was it like when it was very young? How is it aging? What will its eventual evolution lead to? What is outside the universe? Even questions like religious questions, like is there a God?
Right.
That sort of thing has some impact on astronomy, or at least astronomy has some impact on it, because as we study the universe, you know, if you believe in God, then you might say, well, God created the universe. Then studying the universe is teaching you more about how that might have come to be. Hmm. Or it might show you that there is no God, or it's not the God you thought, or whatever. I'm not going to lay that out here.
Right.
The point is that the impact of studying the universe itself is clearly has an impact on philosophy, religion, all these existential problems, because the universe exists and we exist in it. It is the existential framework against which we measure everything.
Yeah. So you know, you hear this kind of emerging voice from atheists these days. You know, Tim Minchin and Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris and all those people trying to kind of diminish superstition and credulity. But it sounds like what you're saying is a believer can fit in this world, and you don't seem terribly concerned about that. At least maybe you don't want to talk about that right now.
Oh, I'm happy to talk about anything. Tim Minchin, love that guy.
I did too.
He came here to Boulder. That was such a fun night. The idea of belief, and there's so many there's so much weight, so much baggage associated with just these ideas, let alone the terms we use.
Right.
When I talk about belief, I usually mean it in the sense of thinking something is true without evidence or even despite evidence. Now, you could say, I believe in evolution, and that might be the wrong term to use because it's not a belief system. It is a scientific fact. You don't believe in evolution. You trust evolution. You consider evolution to be correct. And, you know, I'm not going to split hairs here. You know, belief, if you want to define it that way, that's fine. My point is that if you want to think something is true despite evidence against it or with no evidence for it or maybe with misinterpreted evidence.
Mm-hmm.
Look, you know, you have the right to do that. There's nothing illegal about that. I will draw the line, just to be clear, when that belief system starts to impact my way of life.
Yeah.
If your belief system says you're not allowed to do this, that, and the other thing, and I say, yeah, well, that's too bad. You can't legislate that.
Right.
You know, I don't want people to teach in a public school that the universe is 6,000 years old. That is demonstrably wrong. We know that is wrong. So for me, that is something you shouldn't be doing. And you know what? The founding fathers agreed with me. But despite all of that, you can believe in whatever you want and still appreciate the universe. We know this is a fact because we know that a lot of scientists, not a lot anymore, but back in the day, a lot of scientists were very religious. Newton was very religious.
Yeah.
You can run down that list. Einstein had a metaphorical God. I don't think he believed in a literal God the way most people think, but it's okay for that. And if you – what I think a lot of folks don't understand is that if you start to appreciate things, if you start to look into the science, if you start to observe the natural world for what it is, that is hopefully that will guide your thinking a little bit. And if you have some sort of belief system which is top heavy and unbalanced, maybe that'll shake your faith in it. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I don't think it's ever a bad thing to have your faith shaken, even when it comes to science. Science is all about self-inspection and changing your mind when the evidence is better. That is one of the reasons why I try not to be too strident.
Yeah.
When the stakes are not freedom, liberty, or anything like that. If it's just somebody's personal belief system, hey, you know, come over here and look at this. This, you know, this is pretty interesting, and let them hopefully guide themselves to what is correct.
I'm guessing that over time when you go and talk to people and encounter them, you know, chat with them about their beliefs and what they think about certain things, I'm guessing you come across some common myths. You encounter the same – is that true, I guess? Are there some myths that you – that kind of drive you crazy but you keep hearing them?
How much time do we have?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, there are lots of them, and a lot of them are mundane. Standing eggs on in on the equinox, although that one is going away. That was
right.
That was a big myth for a long time. That one's sort of dying off. There are a million of them like that, and the internet makes it a lot easier for these things to spread.
Right.
There are pieces of art that people draw that then get spread around as being astronomical photographs. That's very common, and they a lot of these are beautiful pieces of art, but they are misrepresenting the way the real world is.
Right.
Things like that, those get on the web. There are also sort of, I don't want to say abuses of science necessarily, but the way science gets twisted. Life in meteorites is a big one. There's a group that keeps publishing papers about this when it's clearly incorrect. They're not finding fossilized protozoa in meteorites. This is just, these are probably samples of rock from Earth. But what happens is this gets reported straight, and then it's all over everybody's Twitter feed and Facebook pages. And, you know, folks have to come in like me or other people and say, yeah, not so much here. That's the sort of thing that makes me crazy. And then there's also, of course, things like the moon hoax, where people think the Apollo landings were faked.
I want to ask you about that. How is it that this idea that the moon landing was faked, how is it that that thing never seems to go away?
It's not as popular at such a high level as it was 10 years ago.
So you think it's diminishing?
It's certainly metamorphosed. It was always around. Ever since the Apollo program, there were people, you know, crackpot conspiracy theories way out on the fringes. then it got a little bit more popular when the internet came around, and then Fox TV aired a TV show about it in 2001, where it became massively popular. There was sort of a mini boom of really badly put together videos and books and websites all sort of parroting each other, self-reinforcing to the point where people are like, oh, did you hear? I saw these five websites. And it's like, yeah, they're all saying exactly, I mean, literally the same thing. Right. So they're just stealing from each other. And then it kind of went away. And now it's just sort of one of those, you know, Kennedy was a second shooter, you know, this, that, and the other thing. These are just sort of mild buzzing noise on the internet that you can fairly safely ignore.
But you seem pretty optimistic that, I mean, I mentioned this in the introduction, that you're seeing kind of a turn in popular culture. Where in the past, as you've said, you know, the skeptic was the loser in the program. Now he's the, you know, the Big Bang Theory, for example. I mean, you see these guys as protagonists now.
Yeah, it's still true that the scientist is used as a foil for evil, or you know, just as the character that does bad things for very shallow reasons. And you know, Christmas time is the worst for that, because the skeptic is always proven wrong when Santa Claus takes a bite out of the cookie and leaves it for the kids in the morning. Right. Whatever, something like that.
Yeah.
That's sort of aggravating, because that is a sort of a mind worm. It gets into the public culture that skepticism is equal to cynicism. We're just trying to destroy all the good and fun things in life. And it's like, that's not true at all. You look around, go outside at night during a meteor storm. There are so many things that when you see them and you understand what you're seeing, your jaw will hit the floor. Yeah. That's reality. That's actually happening. That's the message of science and skepticism, is just to be careful not to fool yourself. So it's easy to conflate that with cynicism. You're wrong, and I hate everything that's bright and beautiful in the world. That's not what this is all about. So over the past few years, to see scientists being portrayed more positively in movies and on television, and yeah, sure, Big Bang Theory, I've seen a lot of fascinating discussion about it. It's basically nerdery in blackface, somebody said.
Wow.
And it's like, but yeah, and I thought that's, you know, I can understand that viewpoint, that this is sort of, if you want to call it nerd racism, making fun of nerds and all that. It's like, well, yeah, actors, because the actors are not nerds themselves, so what? Every actor you see is probably not a medical doctor or a fighter pilot or whatever. But the fact of the matter is, some of the writers and one of the producers of the show, of Big Bang Theory, are full-fledged A-plus geeks. Oh my gosh, they know their stuff. So that show comes from a place of honesty and comes from a place of truth about the geek culture, and then just exaggerates it for comedic effect, because comedy, that's what it does on television. Now, I'm not going to say whether that's a good or a bad thing. I happen to like the show, and I like the idea that this stuff is becoming more known in the public eye. I mean, what would the public even know about Comic-Con if it weren't for Big Bang Theory? So, you know, I think that's fine. And, you know, they had a whole story arc with NASA, and they had an episode where they were beaming lasers off the moon to determine its distance and to measure that the moon is actually moving away from the Earth very slowly. That's all based on real science. They exaggerated a little bit for the show, but that's based on real science. And if people walk away from that show, even with a little bit of that, and they go, huh, and look it up online, then yes, I will cheerlead that with my last breath.
The astronomer Phil Plait is with us. He writes the Bad Astronomy blog on Slate.com. He's the author of the book Death from the Skies, The Science Behind the End of the World. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio, back now with the astronomer Phil Plait. He writes the Bad Astronomy blog on Slate.com, author of the book Death from the Skies, The Science Behind the End of the World. So I mentioned your book. You wrote this book a few years ago. The title, I gather, was only partially tongue-in-cheek, right?
I studied exploding stars for my PhD And that was a funny thing. I was actually studying the environment around a star that exploded. I was more interested in the gas that was around it. For me, the star that exploded was a flashbulb that lit up its environment. And I started thinking about that, just how much energy that was, how violent it was. And I became really interested in sort of these apocalyptic events in space. And over time, I was writing about them more and more and realized, you know, this might make a good book. And that's when Death from the Skies sort of erupted full-blown from my brain. I wanted it to be a book about everything I could think of, and I mean everything, that could either wipe out life on Earth or physically destroy the planet. Turns out, you know, blowing up a planet's really hard, despite the Death Star in Star Wars. It turns out that's really hard to do. But disrupting the biosphere of a planet is super easy to do. It's kind of amazing we've been around this long, and the fact that we have shows that it's actually really hard for these astronomical events to really put the hurt on us. But they're out there, and so it's fun to think about. And I can probably strike this balance of, let's talk about an apocalyptic asteroid impact, but then show that, hey, you know, if it weren't for that 165 million years ago, we wouldn't be here.
Yeah.
We don't want one to happen now, but I wouldn't go back in time to prevent that other one from happening. There are no stars nearby that can blow up and really hurt us. But it's interesting to think about what would happen if there were.
Yeah.
And people love watching horror movies, thrillers. I do. People love going on roller coasters and getting the pants scared off of them because you know that ride's going to end. It's a great adrenaline rush while it's happening. And then when it's done, you can laugh about it. Well, in this case, these are real events. You can read about them. They're really interesting. It's a lot of fun. And then at the end, you can kind of say, yeah, that's cool. And the good news is it probably won't happen. And for the ones that can, that there is some enough of a chance that you go,
yeah.
It turns out there may be things we can do to either prevent them or to mitigate the damage they do. So all in all, you know, despite the title and despite the last chapter of this book being about the end of the universe itself,
yeah.
I consider this book to be somewhat uplifting. It's like, this is how amazing everything is in the universe, and the stuff that's amazing and scary is stuff we can do about. So let's get moving. Let's do something about it.
Well, that was the thrust of the chapter on asteroids, is that events of astronomy can in fact kill us, as you say, but in some cases, our study of astronomy can actually save us. And I wanted to talk about, there was an asteroid that you've talked about, discovered in 2004. It's really big, and it's headed our way. And we were pretty worried about it for a while, because if things had worked out, you know, it had the potential of that the Earth's gravity could kind of bend the orbit of the asteroid just enough that 7 years later it could have really actually hit us. I mean, we dodged the bullet, I guess, but I guess we learned a lot from that experience.
That's right. The asteroid was 2004 MN4, I believe was the designation. It was given the name Apophis. Mm-hmm. And Apophis is an asteroid. It's a rock about 250 yards across, something like that. And it's not a dinosaur killer. The one that wiped out the dinosaurs was something like 6 miles across, you know, something somewhat larger than Mount Everest.
Yeah.
We know that those are very rare, only happen on the order of, you know, tens of millions of years when they hit us. And we know there's nothing like that out there with our name on it right now. The smaller ones, like the one that came in over Russia this year,
it
came in over Chelyabinsk, those are small enough that the damage they do is relatively superficial. It's not something you want to ignore. But it's not something that is going to destroy an entire city necessarily. But then there are these ones like Apophis, which are in the 150-yard to, you know, mile size, or even smaller than that. Those are the ones that can get pretty deep into our atmosphere. They can still explode or hit the ground and do an equivalent damage as a nuclear weapon as far as explosive energy. So these are the ones we're worried about. And for a little while, Apophis looked like it was on an orbit where, as you said, in 2029, it would swing by. In 2029, I should say, it'll still swing by very close.
Yeah.
It'll be underneath our geostationary satellites, but it's going to miss. But if it came in at just the right angle, just the right speed, it will swing around again in 7 years and then hit us in 2036. And for a little while, there was a non-zero chance it would do that. Now we know with better follow-up observations, it's absolutely going to miss in 2036. We know it's not going to hit us. But it taught us that, you know, in the movies and in popular culture, the asteroid is spotted. We have, you know, X months before it hits us. It comes straight in and bang. It's not like that.
Yeah.
Most of the time, or almost all of the time, these things are going to swing by the Earth first and then on some later pass hit us. So that taught us that even if it's far away and it looks like it's going to miss, we need to be careful and make sure it's not going to hit us again on some later pass. That was a good lesson. I mean, that was a good thing. I'm glad it's not going to hit us.
Yeah,
but even so, it taught us something important that we needed to know.
Well, let me ask some of the what-if questions, because they did occur to me. What would happen if that thing were to hit? I mean, it sounds kind of spectacular, pretty terrifying in some ways.
Well, put it this way. The Chelyabinsk asteroid, this was the object that came in February.
Yeah.
Oh, boy, time flies, doesn't
yeah.
it? That was something that was probably 50 feet across. So, you know, maybe the size of a house. It came in at a shallow angle. It was extraordinarily bright, left that tremendous vapor trail. It exploded because it has a huge amount of energy. It's moving very rapidly. It disintegrated in the Earth's atmosphere and deposited all that energy as an explosion, which shattered windows and injured people. Now, that was something 50 feet across. Apophis now is something that is 700 feet across. So it is, let's see, 14 cubed, 1,000 times bigger in mass. So it would be an explosion, something much, much larger, something in the, you know, 15 megaton range, 15 million tons of TNT. So there you're talking about a tremendous fireball, which would set fire to the ground underneath it or, you know, any buildings or anything nearby. A shock wave, which would just flatten things for hundreds of square miles and would not be globally apocalyptic, but would be locally apocalyptic.
Yeah.
And that is something that astronomers are seriously concerned about, especially in that size range, because those are objects we can spot years in advance. We have telescopes looking up for those kind of things, but we don't have enough. And the smaller ones like Chelyabinsk, they're too small to see easily well in advance. But at the size range of like the size of a football field, you know, 100 yards, those are the ones that can start to do serious damage. And they're big enough that we can see them in advance with enough lead time that we can maybe do something about it.
Hmm.
That's why there's the B612 Foundation, a good group of folks who want to find these things and do something, send up a spacecraft to move them out of the way so they don't hit us. And there are other groups who are concerned about this as well. And even as we're sitting here, the NASA budget
yeah.
for fiscal year 2014, for starting in October of this year, that's coming out. And there is an item in there about bagging and tagging an asteroid, a small one, something
yeah.
20 feet across, something like that. To have a mission to go out and grab one and bring it back near the Earth, not in low Earth orbit or anything like that, but just close enough that we can then send people up and investigate it up close so that we can learn about asteroids more. It's primarily a scientific mission, not a planetary defense mission. But everything we learn about asteroids feeds into our knowledge of how we can prevent an impact.
You sound a little skeptical, at least, that some of the writing you've done initially sounds like you're not sure exactly how it could work, that you tow this thing back to Earth and put it in an orbit around Earth's moon. Does it sound feasible at all?
Oh, absolutely. I wanted to be clear, and I wrote a very long article about it because I wanted to make sure that people understood. The science and engineering of this is absolutely doable.
Yeah,
we understand how to do all of these things more or less. There are complications. These asteroids aren't just out there. They're spinning. You have to figure out some way of how to stop it from spinning. And a lot of them are tumbling. Like if you take a potato and throw it, it'll just tumble end over end. And that makes it much harder to catch. And it's the same thing with an asteroid. So there are huge problems, engineering problems to overcome, but nothing that is science fiction. This is all completely doable. My concerns are timing. My concerns are finding a suitable rock. You're talking about something that's incredibly small.
Mm.
It's 25 feet across. Those are we only know of a hand, literally, well, literally a handful, but numerically a dozen asteroids that small. They could be very long and tumbling and difficult to deal with. We don't know their exact size. So the main problem here is finding them first. And I don't know if we're spending the money correctly to categorize these asteroids the way we should be. There are plans in works. The B612 Foundation wants to launch a probe to do this. Amy Meinzer, who is a scientist with JPL and worked on NASA's WISE mission, is working on a mission called NEOCAM, which is the Near-Earth Object Camera, that should be able to find a lot of these things as well. I love both of these missions. Mm-hmm. I think both of them should be funded, launched, and looking for these objects. The point is, this is a while it's feasible, it is a complex, difficult, time-consuming project that's going to cost a lot of money. And if it's going to cost $2.5 billion, which is what one study predicts it will cost, where's that money going to come from? You rob Peter to pay Paul in a lot of these situations. NASA has a finite budget. And if you want $2.5 billion over the next 10 years to do something, that's $250 million a year. That's got to come from some other probably worthy project. That's my concern. I think NASA's budget should just be raised. Just here's more money to do cool stuff. That would be awesome, but that's never the way it actually turns out.
Yeah. Phil Plait is with us. He writes the Bad Astronomy blog on Slate.com, author of the book Death from the Skies, The Science Behind the End of the World. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back now with the astronomer Phil Plait. Here's an email from Dave who writes, with all of the planets we're discovering in other solar systems, I was wondering how far off we are from having optics good enough to start detecting signs of life on them.
That's a good question and something astronomers are thinking about very carefully right now. We know of close to 1,000 confirmed planets orbiting other stars, and we have candidates, that is, objects that we think are planets, but we haven't confirmed them yet. Yeah. There are a couple of thousand more, so there are quite a few, and this is only looking in one small part of the sky. We think, extrapolating to the number of stars in the galaxy, that there are tens or even hundreds of billions, with a B, planets orbiting stars in our galaxy, which is phenomenal. Mm. And you would expect that, some percentage of those, of maybe a tiny percentage, we don't know, are the size of Earth and the right distance from their star to have liquid water. And we know that way back when, the Earth actually had life arise on it almost within, minutes of the conditions being correct. Certainly within a couple hundred million years, which is peanuts in the life of a planet.
Yeah.
So it seems like a pretty good bet that there's life out there, but how do you find it? Well, there are a handful of planets that we've seen. We have direct images of them, mostly because they're young and hot, and so they glow in the infrared. That makes them easy to spot. But the idea of actually seeing them, there are ways of doing that. You can block the starlight using different techniques and let the planet's reflected light shine through. And if you can do that, then it just becomes an engineering problem to be able to break that light up into a spectrum, like a rainbow of colors, that allows you to fingerprint the planet, to be able to see the chemical signatures of things like oxygen. If you see the signature of O2, an oxygen molecule, that's a very unstable molecule, and we're pretty sure that to have it in an atmosphere at high quantities, you basically have to have biology. Just natural processes get rid of it so quickly. So it's not a guarantee, but it's a nice it'd be a nice sign. To be able to do that, you just need bigger and better telescopes.
Right.
We're learning how to do that. And so I think NASA is funded to build something like that eventually. Or I shouldn't say is funded, but has been tasked to do that. They've wanted to do this for years. I think if we dedicated the money and time and effort to it, we could have a telescope like that in 10 or 15 years. So I don't think it's going to be, 100 years or 1,000 years. I think it could be, 20 years or less. Because not only do we could use a telescope like that, but we're getting better at just using the techniques of the telescopes we have now to observe these things better and better. It's entirely possible that we could have signs. Somebody could be clever enough to determine this in the next few years. I'm not saying it's going to happen. I'm saying it's. I wouldn't discount that possibility.
I want to ask you about the last chapter of your book, which I didn't find bleak at all. I found it kind of astounding and sort of miraculous sounding. I mean,
it was depressing to write, I'll tell you that.
Maybe. But, yeah. I mean, it's called The End of Everything. And I wanted you to read this sort of chapter introduction, if you don't mind, because there are so many questions from that chapter that came up for me that I wanted to get at. Do you mind reading that section?
No, not at all. The book Death from the Skies, every chapter is a different way of wiping out life on Earth, asteroid impacts, nearby supernova, black holes. And I started each one with a little story. And this is the only one where it was just sort of more of a descriptive what's happening. It's short. I can read that for you now. Black, nothing, empty. Everything is dark. No stars dot the inky sky. No galaxies can be seen. They're all long since dead, gone, disintegrated as their very constituents have decayed into nothingness. Nothing has occurred in the universe for countless years. It's a cold, almost entirely empty void. For trillions of trillions of years, this emptiness endures. But then, suddenly, in one tiny corner of the universe, no different from any other, a phase change snaps into existence. Like crystals growing in a saturated solution, this realignment in the very structure of space and time expands. It spreads outward at nearly the speed of light, enveloping more and more space. What it leaves behind is nothing, or at least nothing we can understand. Matter, energy, even space and time are destroyed, transformed in the wake of this quantum bubble. When it's done, it has consumed the entire universe, and what is left after that is something we may never know.
So I'll pose the question you ask in the book. What will the universe look like in a trillion, trillion, trillion years? Very different.
Incredibly different. In fact, alien to what we think of now. It's fascinating to me that we can even understand what the universe might look like so far in the future that the age of the universe now is like one tick on the clock. 13 billion years is nothing compared to a trillion or a quadrillion or a Google years. But we can extrapolate the laws of physics that far. Now, right now, we live in a very active, energetic universe. Stars are busily being formed. Galaxies are swirling. We think that the lifetime of a star, the lifetime of the oldest possible star, is about a trillion years. The sun is, for example, 5 or 6 billion, or is 4.5 billion years old, and will be a normal star for another few billion years. It's very roughly middle aged.
Yeah,
that's 10 billion years. Now we're talking about a time span 100 times that, 1,000 billion years, a trillion years. That's how long the oldest star can possibly last. And we're in that part of time where, you know, maybe we'll run out of material to make stars in a trillion years. So in 2 trillion years, or in 10 trillion years, or 100 trillion years, who cares? Just, you know, throw that number out there. Yeah. There will no longer be any stars. Even the ones who use their fuel at the most miserly rate will die. And at that point, the sky is dark. There will be flares of brightness when dead stars collide and various things happen. But then for a long time, nothing is going to happen. But you start getting into a little bit of fuzzy physics where we think that subatomic particles can decay. Protons, which make up all the matter around you, protons, neutrons, and electrons, we think that protons can decay. And when they do, matter itself will fall apart. Now, this won't happen for about 10 to the 40 years. In other words, a 1 with 40 zeros after it. Now, right now, we're at a 1 with 10 zeros after it. Yeah. So, you know, this is a long, long, long time from now. But eventually, matter itself will decay. And then the universe will just be sort of this thinly spread soup. Even black holes, we think, can decay. This is theoretical, but the physics seems pretty firm. Instead of just sucking matter down all the time, very, very slowly, they can emit matter. And over vast amounts of time, now we're talking about a 1 with 90 zeros after it, something like that, they too will decay. So in a Google years, there will be nothing left in the universe except a completely thin soup of subatomic particles and energy. In the meantime, there are these other more subtle effects where right now we can see billions of light years away. We can see galaxies that are still, because of light travel time effects, we're seeing the light that they emitted billions of years ago.
Right.
They're still forming, and when the universe was young, over time, that gets harder and harder to do. And in a trillion years, we won't be able to see that far away. We'll only be able to see things that are happening right nearby. These are all very subtle effects. I described them in the book.
Yeah.
So again, every step in this process makes the universe look and feel and literally be different than the universe we're familiar with right now. So eventually there's going to come a time when the universe is just going to be completely alien to us. I have to wonder, you know, that kind of time, if there's going to be any life in the universe, and it's hard to even imagine what it might be like.
Gosh, I mean, you say in the book that if we want to survive into the far future, we're going to have to change ourselves in such fundamental ways that, you write, you wouldn't even consider the result to be human anymore.
Sure. In a biological sense, absolutely, because, yeah, you know, species have to be able to breed, and we wouldn't be able to breed with one of these far-flung humans of the future. But right now, we're very profligate with our energy. We eat, we grow food, we eat it, we run around, we do things. In a long time from now, the universe is going to be so cold and all these energy sources will be used up that to have any sort of meaningful interaction with the universe, you can't consume energy like we do, where, you know, thousands of calories a day. In this case, it'll be, you know, one calorie every million years. We'd have to really slow down our metabolism. There's just no energy out there to use up. When you think about things like that, and this isn't crazy to think about, it's an interesting intellectual exercise, actually. What's it going to be like? And it can't be human. We can't even maintain our body temperature at those kind of energy consumption rates. So will we even have a physical form? That's very Star Trek-like to think about that sort of thing. But if it is, it'll have to be completely different than what we're doing now.
Mm. And you see in the book, you see despite the fact that something that's going to end in some way, there is still a hope. You say, I mean, for maybe not for us exactly, but whoever comes next. How does knowing this, understanding this, contemplating all of this, how does it change our perspective, do you think?
Well, that's a good question. I think that's going to be different for everybody.
Yeah.
For me, I just like knowing things. I want to know what's going to happen. If the universe is going to end in fire or ice or with a banger or a whimper, I just want to know. Mm. If that's just knowledge for its own sake, and that's wonderful and pure and beautiful. If you're trying to plan something, well, that's fine. You know, everybody has to leave a will of some sort or get health insurance or you're going to exercise to prolong your life. If you want to prevent something from happening like an asteroid impact, then that knowledge is very useful. What I was describing when I was reading that opening to the book is that there's this idea that the universe, even though it becomes spread out and cold and formless and without shape in a Google years from now, there could be a rebirth. There's a quantum collapse. It's a complicated quantum mechanical process that may actually re-energize the universe. But in the process, it erases all of space and time. So not only will space go away, but even time, maybe even our existence now, will be erased from the memory of the universe. Whether that happens or not, that's something interesting to know. If it does happen, there's not much you can do to prevent it or to plan on what the next thing is, at least not right now. Who knows? The more we learn, maybe there will be something we can do. But for me, that's hope. That shows me that the universe will continue. It may be in a completely different form than it is now. Mm-hmm. But it shows that the universe itself, that existence itself, will continue. And I find that very hopeful, very uplifting.
Let me ask you this finally. You wrote your book, Death from the Skies, 2008, I think it was. In another 10 years, do you ever wonder, will the basics or what part of the ideas that are in that book will change? I mean, how much are we evolving in terms of our understanding of all this stuff?
Some of it will change and some of it probably won't. We understand, for example, how the sun changes over time.
Yeah.
So my chapter on the sun turning into a red giant and frying the earth probably won't change that much. Some of the details might. asteroid impacts, that may change completely. We may develop a great planetary defense system and be able to prevent all asteroids down to the size of a grapefruit from hitting the Earth, maybe. I don't know. That could change. There is one part where I talk about mass extinction events appearing to happen on a semi-regular basis, about every 60 million years on Earth. And, you know, trying to find an astronomical basis for that, there was this idea that the sun orbits the center of the galaxy on a bobbing path that goes up and down out of the plane of the galaxy. That was relatively new research when I wrote about it. A paper just came out saying probably not so much. That may not be connected. So you never know when new research is going to come along with a new idea of a way of wiping out life on Earth, which means a new chapter, yay, but also something that says, no, you were wrong, which is good, because that's how we learn. That's how we find out new stuff. And so I welcome research like that. I think it's great.
That's Phil Plait, an astronomer and creator and writer of the Bad Astronomy blog on Slate.com. Phil Plait, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me on.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.